and you're very welcome to another episode of Sparking Change. I'm Dil Vikramasinghe. Thank you for taking the time to catch up with the latest social justice and mental health stories as we speak to those who are affected by the issues and hear from the change makers who are making a real difference, all with the view, of course, to inspire you to be part of the change. Please remember to subscribe, rate and review us, and do get in touch with the show by emailing us on sparkingchange@headstuff.org or follow me on Twitter @DilW or the show @SparkingChange1. Now, a word from our sponsor. Our mental health is our most precious resource. How we feel about ourselves plays a big part in the job that we have, the quality of our relationships and our resilience to cope with the challenges of life. Insight Matters provides inclusive and affordable mental health support services with a dedicated and talented team of 45 psychotherapists. Call us on 01-891-0703 or visit insightmatters.ie and start your journey of self-discovery. If you'd like to advertise on Sparking Change and reach thousands of engaged listeners, do get in touch. Smashing Times Theatre and Film Company is a not-for-profit, human rights-based organization that uses creative process, theatre and film to promote human rights, gender equality, reconciliation and social inclusion for all. And interestingly, they are at a very interesting crossroads because they have just launched a Smashing Times International Center for the Arts and Human Rights, which is quite a departure. And I'm delighted to be speaking to Mary Moynihan, who is the artistic director at Smashing Times. You're very welcome to Sparking Change, Mary.
Hi, Dale. How are you?
So, Mary, now I've spoken to you many times over the years, but let's start with the work of Smashing Times, a theatre company. How did it all start?
Okay, well, that's going back to 1991, and I was working with the Focus Theatre in Dublin with an amazing woman called Deirdre O'Connell. And Deirdre was Irish-American. Her parents were from Ireland, and Deirdre was born in the Bronx in New York. And she became an actor, but she trained with Lee Strasberg in the actor's studio. So Deirdre was destined for a brilliant career. She was training with the likes of Marilyn Monroe and all these top actors. And Deirdre said she had a vision that she wanted to come back to Ireland to train actors. And what she wanted to do was pass on her knowledge of the Stanislavski system of actor training. And Deirdre had been trained with Lee Strasberg, and Lee Strasberg was teaching his version, if you like, of Stanislavski system. Konstantin Stanislavski was a Russian theatre practitioner, founded the Moscow Art Theatre, and he's considered the founding father of actor training, but a brilliant theatre person and known throughout the world in the arts world. But what Deirdre would always say is that Strasberg was teaching the Western version and she wanted to teach the Eastern version, going back to this pure sense of Stanislavski system. So Deirdre came back to America, or back to Ireland, and where she met Luke Kelly from the Dubliners, and herself, she married Luke, and herself and Luke Kelly and other artists at the time decided to look for a venue to set up the Focus Theatre in Dublin, and where Deirdre ran the Stanislavski studio. And they did that in, you know, from the 1960s on. And then I was very lucky to get involved with Deirdre in the Focus Theatre, and Deirdre became my friend and mentor, and she trained me as an actor and director. But it was while I was working with Deirdre that I just recognised the power and the passion of theatre and an art form. And back in 1991, I would say theatre was quite elitist back then, because, for example, I didn't know about people like Augusto Boal, who's a Brazilian theatre practitioner, using art to promote social justice and you know, Theatre of the Oppressed is his system. But I just recognised, I says, what is this medium? This is an incredible medium. The people who come in and work here, yes, we're training as actors, but look at the confidence building, look at the sense of self we're developing, look at how some of these writers we're coming across are using their work to talk about issues. Can we do that about the issues in our lives? All of this sort of stuff is going on for us. And what we did was a group of women who were working in Focus Theatre with Deirdre's blessing decided to set up our own company, primarily to make work for women and by women, but also as well to bring theatre out of the traditional theatre space into the communities. So we started looking at playwrights like Franca Rama and Dario Fo, Italian playwrights, and the brilliant work they were doing. And we did a Franca Rama piece. It was to do with different, I'm trying to remember, one of the pieces was called The Rape, actually, which was to do with sexual violence. And then there was pieces to do with just the whole discrimination against women. And this would have been kind of a bit way out back in 1991. So we did these pieces and then brought them out, literally got on a bus and went out to places like Tala and Ballymun. So here we were working at night in the Focus Theatre, putting on Strindberg and Chekhov, and then getting on a bus and going out to Tala and Ballymun and doing Dario Fo and Francorama. So it was very exciting.
But what was the response like back then?
The response was like, when we first went in, I think maybe the groups, for example, we did something with, there was a festival in Tala, a women's health and arts festival. So we went out and we just did the show. But after the show, we had a post-show discussion and we were amazed at the reaction we got. The audience loved the show. And the audience, the post-show discussion became, we did a few of these, the post-show discussions became as long as the shows, because there was so much coming up in the discussions about people relating to the issues that were coming up in the plays and then talking about their own lives. And it was really interesting. And it was because the post-show discussions became so long and so animated that we said, look, we need to do something. So we started designing workshops where we would do a performance and then say, right, instead of talking, let's get up and work it out on our feet. So that was really the idea of where the workshops came. And then it was around that time we did discover more about Augusta Boal and his methods that he was doing to try and make theatre more relevant to local communities and how you can engage with the power of theatre. For example, if you look at what's happening sometimes in countries where dictatorships are taking over, one of the first things they do is close down the theatres and close down artists, because artists are about, hopefully some of us are about using our work to question what's happening in society, using our work to explore different identities, using our work to challenge or to be provocative. And we recognise that power. So there was a great reception to the work. And from there, then we started working a lot with local communities, doing professional performances, but also as well developing the community side where you're looking at engaging with communities to make their own shows around what was happening in their communities. So back then we were looking at issues like social deprivation and unemployment, and then we were at anti-racism became a big issue because we were working a lot in the inner city where all the asylum seekers were being put into these areas and there was very little happening to promote integration. And there was huge problems going on. And then, of course, the issue years later in the communities, the issues of suicide and positive of mental health, all of these issues were coming up. So we were using the arts around all those issues. And then a big thing that Smashing Times did was is that because when we set up in 1991, there was still a war going on in Northern Ireland. So we ended up working up there using the arts to go in and work with different communities. And we did that pre-ceasefire and post-ceasefire. And we've done a huge amount of work then using the arts to promote reconciliation. So that's storytelling and going in and bringing different communities together in Northern Ireland, and primarily the Catholic and the Protestant communities, but also working then with ex-prisoners and different sides of the conflict, and using the arts to promote reconciliation and to enable people to talk about difficult issues. And so that work was, I believe, based on the success of the work in Northern Ireland, that we were then approached by organisations throughout Europe who were coming to us, because in Europe, people were experiencing, for example, the whole migrant issues that were happening and the whole refugee crisis. And we found organisations were coming to us to look for our expertise of how you use the arts to deal with these issues. So we started linking with groups in Europe, going to Europe to work. We've developed relationships with a fantastic theatre company called That Theatre in Belgrade in Serbia, where Dijana Milosevic was working, using her art forms to work with women who had experienced the former conflict in the former Yugoslavia. So it was joining up our resources, if you like, to look at how we could use this work, how we could share our expertise, but also look at the issues that are happening in Europe today. So we've done a lot of work in Europe. And over the years, we went from being a theatre company to also bringing in film and new digital technologies. And this year, because of the huge amount of work where it's art-based, but then it's also human rights-based, and it was looking at how we can combine them and bring them to the next level. And that's what's led us to set up the Smashing Times International Centre for the Arts and Human Rights.
You're smiling as you're saying that, because it's just such an interesting evolution that to go from a theatre company to actually, it's like you're change makers. You're actually influencing positive social change through your work.
Well, yes, we would. I suppose initially when we set up, we were primarily to make art for ourselves and for communities. But yes, within the company, all the members all had a vision, if you like, for trying to I suppose, promote some sort of change in society to make the world a better place. And part of our philosophy is that we're not going in and telling people what to do. This is really important, because we would say we're artists. And what we like to do as artists is we like to say, how can we use this powerful art form to explore the world we're living in and to look at the possibility of change in society? And a key part of that work is engaging with communities, where it's about raising awareness and questioning and exploring where the solutions, if you like, are coming from the communities themselves and are coming from the people we're working with. So, for example, at Smashing Times, we would partner. I'm an artist and a theatre and filmmaker, but I like to partner. If I'm working on an anti-racism project, I like to partner with someone who's an expert in anti-racism. And if we work on positive mental health, we have a panel that we've set up of counsellors and psychotherapists. And they, so it's bringing these synergies together, or creating these synergies.
It's like multidisciplinary.
Yes, very much so. And it's just really exciting what comes up then, because there's just huge developments that happen. And what's really interesting about the arts is, and if you look at practitioners like Augusta Boal, you don't, and Boal would always say this, and I thought this is interesting, and it's the same in our company, you don't suddenly say, oh, I'm going to do this project and I think X, Y, and Z. It's because you're working in a certain way and meeting different people, ideas start to spark. And if you like, the need comes from the current work you're doing, which leads to the development of the next project. So it's very organic, if that makes sense, that sometimes the ideas for the projects are coming from what we're doing at the moment, which leads to other things. Have I an example of that?
Because I remember seeing, I don't know what year this was, but this was a while back anyway. I remember being at a conference, a mental health conference, and I think the charity was Sea Change. And Smashing Times had a couple of performers who basically talked about, you know, mental health stories. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, you had a psychotherapist who then talked about the issues. And like it was really interesting, because normally, and I often question this sometimes about some theatre pieces that I've seen over the years, you know, incredibly thought-provoking performances, potentially triggering performances, and then, you know, the performance finishes, the artists, you know, take their bow and then they leave. Yeah. And then the people actually leave and make their way home, having maybe a can of worms being opened and nothing actually is done about it, you know. So you guys have obviously post performance discussions, but you go further. You actually kind of extend some kind of a support to the people who were there, who maybe can actually do something about the issues that were brought up by the performance. And I think that there's kind of this response, like you kind of take responsibility a little bit about what you've just provoked in the audience, which I think is really important, as opposed to theatre pieces that kind of, you know, leave you with this thing, and then, you know, sometimes it's good, but sometimes it can be just be the one thing that could tip someone over the edge.
Absolutely. And again, that's what that from working for years in this work, we've developed, I suppose, if you like, expertise but also knowledge about how you deal with this, because as an artist, if you're going to use your art form to look at these issues, you have a huge responsibility. And part of that is making sure that the work you do is yes, it's opening up things, but at the same time, like you said, you have to provide your safety structures and your support structures. And so, for example, you talked about the project Acting for the Future and the performance of testimonies. We actually have a rule in the company, a rule that certain performances are only put on if there's a structured post-show discussion with a support structure around it. And that's really important. So, for example, Testimonies is a play that we have, where it's to do with, we worked with the Samaritans on testimonies as part of a project called Acting for the Future. And as part of that project, we interviewed 10 people who had either lost someone to suicide or been through a suicidal experience themselves and survived. And then the 10 stories were given to two writers, myself and Paul Kennedy. And we scripted 3 monologues. We now have 6 monologues because the play has since developed. And they're all what we call true fiction, in that it is fictional pieces, but everything you see has actually happened to somebody.
And I think one of the pieces, if I remember correctly, it was mother talking about her son who died by suicide because he was gay.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That is one of the pieces written by Paul Kennedy. And these pieces, it's really important that if you put these pieces on, we'll only put them on if there's a post-show discussion. The post-show discussion has to have a panel of the artists and the qualified therapists and counsellors who have worked with us and have gone through a process of prior engagement. So we have a panel set up. There's a huge amount of background work goes on, if you like, to set up the support structure, to set up how it works. And for example, when you go into schools, you've got pre-workshops, post-workshops, you've a whole lot of stuff goes on, as well as the performances and the workshops. Because like you said, you're raising these issues. So you have to have a forum then for some way for the issues to be explored and teased out. And if there's any fallout, there's a support structure around that. So that's really important.
It's fantastic because that was years ago and I remember it like it was yesterday. Now, let's talk about the project the Women in the Equal Europe book, which is also a documentary, which I think I had I played a small part in because I was one of the people interviewed. But it was Europe wide. So how did you go about, what countries were involved? How did you go about picking the stories for this book and documentary?
Okay, the way we work is we do projects, and that project was called Women in an Equal Europe, and out of it came a book called Women in an Equal Europe and a documentary. And I might go back a little if I can to just explain, because I think that's really interesting how that project came about. In 2016, it was the 100th anniversary of the 1916 Easter Rising, and our project for that year was to look at women's stories of 1916. And I remember thinking, well, that's going to be difficult to write a play because there were so few women involved. And of course, when you go and look, you realise, my God, there wasn't just 100, there was over 200 women involved in 1916.
And why aren't they being, celebrated?
Oh, and incredible women, amazing women. And I often think, like, I'm an artist, and my personal philosophy is I'm non-violence, but as an artist I end up exploring stories of women who have chosen violence in their lives as well as women who have chosen non-violence, and I find all of that interesting, and we tell all types of stories. But you had women like Margaret Skinner, an amazing 23-year-old maths teacher who comes over and becomes a soldier for, in the 1916 uprising and all the things she did. The only woman I think that was shot in 1916. But just her incredible story that nobody knows about. And then you've
She's an incredible shot, wasn't she? She's great aim.
She was a sniper. She was stationed in the College of Surgeons on Stephen's Green with Commandant Mallon and Countess Markovitch. And she was a sniper, and she wrote a book called Doing My Bit for Ireland, where you can read her story about what she did in 1916. She then used to take messages from this College of Surgeons down to the GPO and back. It was on her bike, and she'd be dodging bullets on her bike back and forward. And then when she was shot, she did evade arrest. And then she became quartermaster general during the Civil War and the War of Independence, which when I found that piece of information out, I was flabbergasted, amazed by that.
Why don't we have a bridge with her name on it?
Yeah, I know. It's an extraordinary story, so it is. But we found these amazing stories, and we made a theatre performance. And the performance went into schools, and it toured and was shown. We actually performed one of the pieces in City Hall, which is extraordinary because Helena Maloney was one of the women who fought in City Hall, and here we were performing her story in City Hall in 2016. So that was a
goosebumps,
incredible moment. Yeah, absolutely. So that was brilliant. And then following on from that, then we decided, well, hang on, if there's all these hidden stories, how many more hidden stories are there? And then we were asked to do a project around Second World War because it was the 75th anniversary. So we decided to look at women's stories of World War II. And again, thinking maybe we won't find any stories. Now, that was a European project. So that had Spain, Ireland, Germany and Poland. And again, we had partners from the four countries, came up with incredible stories of women active in World War II. And, for example, out of that project, we came across the story of Mary Elms, who's a woman I'm personally very interested in trying to put on our secondary school books, our primary school books. Mary Elms' story should be told because she was this extraordinary Irish woman from Cork, a Protestant woman from Cork, who went to Trinity College, did Spanish and French, then went to the London School of Economics and then to Geneva to study. And while she was there, she heard about the Spanish Civil War and decided she wanted to go and help the people, the internal refugees in Spain, the Spanish people who were fleeing from the fascists within Spain. And she went over to work, and she arrived into Almeria and she arrived in just as this massacre was happening. It was when the city of Malaga fell to the fascists and thousands of people were fleeing Malaga and they were fleeing Malaga along the coast road to Almeria, and they were bombed by the fascists from the sea and the sky, and up to 5,000 men, women and children were butchered, slaughtered. And Mary Elms was there helping those refugees. So it's like a baptism of fire. She stayed then working with the Quakers in Spain right up until Spain fell to Franco. And then she went with the refugees over the mountains into France, where what France did was they rounded up all the Spanish refugees and put them into camps on the beaches. And Mary stayed working with them. And then at one point she did go back to Ireland, but then she came back because then when France fell to the Nazis and the Vichy government was set up in the south, they were arresting the Jewish families. So they started to incarcerate the Jewish families in the camps with the Spanish families. And at one point, a lot of the refugees were moved to a place called Reefsall and Termin Camp. And Mary Elms was working there. And then, of course, when they started to ship the Jewish families up to their debts and outfits out, they knew what was happening, that all the children and the women who were being shipped out were going to be murdered when they got to the gas chambers. Mary and her colleagues did a huge amount of work to rescue Jewish children and then families. And according to Mary's family, she rescued hundreds of people, not just Jewish people, all sorts of nationalities, all different nationalities. And she did Trojan work in saving hundreds of lives. And she was actually arrested by the Gestapo and imprisoned for 6 months and did get out. We're not quite sure why. How she was released, possibly because Ireland was seen as neutral mm-hmm. during the war, and then lived out her life in France, married a Frenchman and had two children. And there's a lovely story because we wrote, put her story into a play, and it's a brilliant play. We've had a huge reaction to it all around the country. And a journalist called Clodagh Finn came to see the play, and she was so inspired, she went off and wrote a book on the life of Mary Elms. So you can actually get this book now. It came out just last November, I think. A Time to Risk All, it's called, and it tells the story of Mary Elms. But I see parallels with her story, that Mary Elms risked her life. Strangers, women risking their lives for strangers is an extraordinary story. But she risked her lives as well for refugees and asylum seekers. And that's what's happening in the world today. You know, so you bring this story into schools, you can talk to young people about how we care about society. What type of world do we want to live in? Mary Elms was standing up on her own way against fascism, and we're experiencing, you know, an attack on human rights today in the world. And even the idea of how we open our arms and welcome in the stranger or welcome in the refugees and asylum seekers, all of those issues could be explored through the arts.
You can draw the parallels. Because it's almost like when you start, you know, looking at history, you know, you kind of let your guard down because you talk about something that happened, you know, so many decades, you know, hundreds of years ago, and then suddenly you're like, well, actually that's still happening right now in the Mediterranean Sea.
Absolutely. And the one thing that was chilling that we found when we were working with our European partners, we were researching the World War II stories and about the rise of fascism and all of that, and our partners were telling us stories that we were kind of about what's happening in Europe today, and you know, in the move to the right and some of the countries we've been working in, and you're listening and they're telling you stories that sounds very familiar to what happened in the period leading up to 1939. And the partners are talking to us about this. We're witnessing these things. And then, as you said, around the refugee and asylum seeker crisis. So history is so important for today. So the arts have been brilliant for that. But during one of the rehearsals, we were, you know, making the play about all these brilliant women. And it was a male actor actually said, well, these are women from 1940s. Who are these women today, if you were to ask? Okay. And everybody had to think for a moment, like, well, who are the Mary Elmses of today? And then the male actor said, well, I love Mary Lawler. She's one of my role models. And the younger actress,
Frontline Defenders, Mary Lawler.
Mary Lawler. Yeah, set up Frontline Defenders, an incredible woman. Frontline Defenders, you know, protects human rights defenders around the world. And she's an extraordinary woman. And some of the younger women didn't know who she was. So we kind of thought, OK, what's going on here? And again, it's the same thing. So that's where the Women in an Equal Europe book came from and the project. We were originally going to do a play, but then we decided, no, it has to be a documentary. And what was interesting about that is, because we do film work, is that if we're developing our performances, usually the material or the spirit of the piece will sometimes give you the shape of the artwork, if that makes sense. And we kept trying to find a way to make a play out of the, if we said, if we interview women today, pick the role models, interview them, make a performance. But then we said, no, it has to be a documentary because we want to hear the original voices. And that was where the documentary came from. And it's an extraordinary documentary where it's all these women talking about their experiences in Europe today, what feminism means to them, what are their personal desires in life? And also then, what's their, you know, how do they feel about society and change in society, being women, and how being a woman has affected them. So I find the interviews in the book absolutely extraordinary, and that's the feedback we're getting, because you're reading about all these women, and I've come to believe that there's, you know, are we looking at ordinary women in extraordinary circumstances, or is it extraordinary women? So not every woman will be like this. And I definitely believe it's all extraordinary women doing extraordinary things, if that makes sense. And I say, I'm sorry, everybody is just a woman, but we're all extraordinary. Ordinary, extraordinary women. That's what I've come to believe, because every woman has an incredible story. If you think about the things we've to put up with in our lives as women, and then for some women, there's other things that they've got to deal with, and how we find ways to make it happen, if you like. And I suppose the stories are telling, you know, the women are talking about the trials and tribulations, but they're also talking about how they succeed. And the spirit of resilience that comes across from the women, and just the humanity and the passion. And maybe this is a stereotype, but a majority of women want to change society for the better. And if women were in positions of power, our society probably would be a lot different.
That is so interesting. What? Because I'm just very conscious that after hearing the whole journey that you went on to actually pick the women, I'm feeling extremely privileged to be one of those women, and I'm also very conscious about the fact that when we did that interview and that documentary, I remember that day in Smock Alley, like I remember the whole, we were in the schoolboys with that beautiful kind of space in Smock Alley. It was all dark.
Yeah.
It's just a chair on the stage and then a light. It kind of felt a little bit like an interrogation, you know, with the interview. But my life was quite different. In the sense that I was still working in Newstalk at the time, and then and now it's like, and it's again, it's interesting about the resilience part, because it's nearly a year. Well, when did we actually do the interview? Was it August last year?
Yeah, they were July and August of last of this year.
Last year. So I'm very conscious about my own, I suppose, circumstances changing since the interview, because obviously I'm not working in Newstalk anymore. And again, it's all about despite, you know, having to face adversity in your life, and even when you think everything is kind of sorted, everything's looking great, you know, life will throw curveballs at you, and then it's your response to it. But ultimately, even now with my shift from working in media, I still want to continue contributing to my environment, because I'm hoping to work as I'm training as a psychotherapist. And I think what you said about women, what do you think is it about women that we want to care for our environment? Is it do you think it's biological, or do you just think it's the fact that we just hate injustice? What do you think?
Oh my god, what do I think? I think that I do believe that both men and women can have a very strong social conscience and want change in society. That I think we live in a patriarchal society, but I don't believe every man wants to be a part of that patriarchal society. So, for example, since we did the documentary, and that was part of when we were editing the documentary, is that the Me Too campaign happened since we did it, which was a huge change. And then obviously in Ireland, we had the abortion referendum and the fact that we now have the right to choose. So all those issues were happening. And I think part of what's come out for me for the Me Too campaign is that we have to be very careful that men are not the enemy. Men are not the enemy. It is a system of patriarchy. It is a system of misogyny. It is a system of control and power and a lack of human rights. All of those things in society that influences who we are and what we do. Okay, and I do think personally, because women have lived as second class citizens for a long time, maybe that's part of what has tuned into some of us about wanting. We understand oppression now. And obviously there's different levels of oppression, but as a woman, you can look back in your life and say, right, I've tried to always stand up against it, but yes, we have experienced discrimination. Okay, so hopefully a part of that has made us recognize this is not right, this shouldn't happen, and I don't want this to happen to other people. Now, not every woman is like that, because we've had the Margaret Thatchers, And we've had the other women that have not wanted social change in society, if you like. So again, it's very hard to determine. I do think too, but I'm always very conscious of that it can't just be because we have children. But I definitely think the fact we have children, men have children too. So I think that's male and female. But I certainly, as someone who has children, I want society to be better for my children. But again,
leave it a better place for them.
Yeah, to leave a better place. But why do, so that question of why do women, maybe women are, you know, because the more we've had men in control of society, we've had more wars in society. Now, this is proven. This is factual. The more you bring women into positions of power, the less conflict we have in society. So that is proven. I definitely think, too, personally, that if you live in a country where women are treated as second-class citizens, very obviously, so for example, if you go to Saudi Arabia or countries like that, where if you bring up young men and women, where the men are, it's ingrained in them that you're this type of person up here, and it's ingrained in the women you're down here. I definitely do think that men have less of a social conscience if they grow up in that type of society.
There's a sense of entitlement.
Yes. Yeah, there's a sense of entitlement. Yes, there's definitely something to do with that gender discrimination that makes them less aware of what it is to treat people as equal. They're growing up in a society that tells you it's okay to treat people differently. That's the problem.
You know, it's absolute conditioning.
Yes.
This is an argument that often people make, you know, if there's more women at the decision-making table, then it'll be a more just society. And then men always say, what are you saying here? That all men are pigs? Like, no, we're not saying that. I think it's because, exactly as you said, boys and girls are being conditioned differently. And what you said there about, you know, this is not... it doesn't mean that all men are like this, but unfortunately, this system that we've created is actually doing a disservice to men as well, because I feel it's killing men. That's why there's so many suicides, male suicides. The majority of them are men, because men find themselves in this, you know, patriarchal society, having to be a certain way, having to act a certain way, and having to take that position of... feeling entitled and being above women. And a lot of men don't like that, you know, because they feel that's really unfair. But when they try and rebel against it, they feel ostracized, you know. And I find that just quite heartbreaking. So it's just interesting how just the world we've created, but art can actually have a huge part in getting people to have these conversations, which I think you guys do through the work that you do, through the theatre company, and through now the website. So talk to me about, so you've done the book, you've done the documentary, now you've launched the website. What's the dream? Because I feel it's like smashing times, world domination.
Well, myself and Frida Manweiler, Frida is company manager, an amazing woman in the company and producer, and we've always had a dream to have our own space. So the idea of the Smashing Times International Centre for the Arts and Human Rights is to provide a resource service for artists who want to explore ways to use their art form to engage with issues. And it's for communities, to bring communities together with artists. And we want to bring international artists to Ireland and Irish artists internationally. And we're looking at the moment, we've set up a website funded by the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht, where we're trying to share stories of arts organisations around the world who are using their arts to promote human rights. So to raise awareness of this. And the website then is, for example, we're doing blogs around powerful women in the arts, and we want people to contribute stories. We're doing pieces on different art companies around the world, and then bring just what's happening in human rights and what's happening in the arts and how we can combine them. And we're looking for space at the moment in to set up in Dublin, a building where we can bring all of this work out into the open, because we're artists. That's what we do. We get together in a space and we work with each other. So we're on the hunt. We're hoping, we're lobbying at the moment, politicians and Dublin City Council, hopefully that they will help us to get a space, because we think this space could be a really valuable resource for Ireland. And it's, what we're saying is, particularly as you see what's happening in the world in terms of attacks on human rights, that it's really important that Ireland steps up to the table to try and lead the way in terms of promoting human rights, and bringing the arts and human rights together is just a wonderful combination. Like, you know, classic examples of the arts for human rights would be, you know, the song Hurricane by Bob Dylan. A brilliant song, but that's an example because, you know, there's a song about the injustice in the criminal justice system. Picasso's Guernica is another great example. And then, so just having these projects where you're reaching out to communities to raise awareness with young people about all these human rights issues. And I actually do have a story around when you're talking about the young men being involved, because we've been working a lot around gender equality recently. And we had a conference in or a symposium in Trinity College Dublin where we did a performance and workshop, theatre workshops, and we brought a load of young people together. But there were a few young men in one of the workshops. And we were talking about gender equality, and one of the young men said, this affects me. He says, I didn't know how to describe it or how to talk about it. But he says, the role models I've been given is that I have to be strong. I have to be a leader. I have to be tough. And the young man sat there and he says, what if I'm none of them? He says, where do I fit in society? He says, where's my sense of, he says, I feel crap. Because I don't fit any of those images. And it was so heartbreaking to see this young man. And it was almost as if it was the first time he could say this, to express how we felt. So these issues are for everybody to bring them together. And really it's about, for me, human rights is about saying, let's make society a better place for all and a fairer and just place for all. And being able to use your arts. Now, I also say too that as an artist, you don't have to use your work for human rights. There should be no pressure on an artist to do that. Just make your art form. But we have always said in Smashing Times that as artists, we never let the issues impinge on the work. We artistically create pieces in response to themes we're interested in. And then they're taken further and used, if you like, through other structures to raise awareness of the issues. So that's how it works. And the arts are just a brilliant way to make the invisible visible, I always say. The arts are brilliant for bringing out what's unspoken, but also just creating this. You know, if you go to a theatre performance and suddenly this connection happens, and these connections are important, that can happen when a piece of art happens. And it's just getting back to those more primal connections and bringing people together to celebrate and to have fun.
But it's also safe as well, because I think it's interesting that people go to the theatre to be entertained.
Yeah.
Right. And or they go to a stand up comedy gig to be entertained. And then in amidst that entertainment, you start talking about something quite serious.
Yeah.
So something, it's almost like a wolf in sheep's clothing. It's almost like you're tricking the audience. You know, you're coming in to have a laugh, and then you talk to them about something serious, you know.
Yeah.
And then maybe people who would normally not talk about a particular issue suddenly find themselves talking about it on their way home, where, you know, it's more difficult to kind of get someone to maybe watch the news or watch a documentary about the refugee crisis. Only certain people who are interested, who care about those issues, will actually switch on the TV at a particular time to watch a particular documentary or read that particular investigative report about it. But when it comes to theatre or comedy or any kind of art form, more of the mainstream are attracted to seeing it, you know, and you get a laugh as well.
Yeah.
People think, okay, I actually enjoyed myself, had a good evening, and also got some food for thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, for example, the project that we run on positive mental health, and you always have to be very sensitive about how you talk about these issues, but it's a project where we explore suicide and what happens in suicide prevention. And we would do performances and workshops, but in the feedback you often get from the young people writing, great fun. Had a brilliant time. So, and we were kind of saying at the beginning, oh my God, they're saying they have great fun and we're talking about suicide prevention and positive mental health. But it is that idea that the young people are engaging in a fun way and then being gently brought in to explore these more sensitive issues, if you like, but within a safe structure. So, and comedy, the theatre masks are comedy and tragedy side by side. You know what I mean? So, and that's the skill of the artist, to use your comedy to, if you like, theatre's full of paradoxes. I don't see it as tricking people. I see it more as a paradox that we're going to, how would I explain it? We're going to make you feel safe in order to take risks, which is a paradox.
Yeah.
And art is all about paradoxes, you know, so it's all about the surface and the depth and exploring all these different things.
So if people want to find out more about Smashing Times or any Just to hear more about the centre, where can they go and can they get involved?
Go to www.smashingtimes.ie. So we've set up the new Smashing Times website for the arts and human rights, and you can find information there about the centre itself, about the theatre and film company, and about Smashing Times Youth Arts as well.
Can people get involved?
Yes, people can get involved, definitely. Often with our projects, we're looking for people to get involved, to attend workshops, to contribute stories. We've lots of different opportunities to contribute stories and blogs, contribute to our blogs on the website. And if you know of any arts and human rights projects that you're aware of that you'd like to share with us, we definitely would love to know more about that.
Fabulous. So that's Mary Moynihan, who's Artistic Director at Smashing Times Theatre and Film Company Limited. Thank you so much for speaking to us here on Sparking Change.
Thank you very much, Dil. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we reached the end of this episode. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did putting it together for you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like what you heard, please leave us a review. Sparking Change is brought to you by Insight Matters, counselling and psychotherapy services in Dublin City Centre. They support over 400 clients a week with a team of 45 talented and dedicated counsellors. Visit insightmatters.ie for more information. Do get in touch with the show by emailing us on sparkingchange@headstaff.org or follow me on Twitter @DillW or the show @SparkingChange1. Massive thank you to my researcher, Jamie Reynolds, and the fantastic Headstaff team. So that's it for this episode of Sparking Change. This is Dil Vikramasinghe, and as always, reminding you that we're all part of one human family and that you too can spark change.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.